She won't ask for it.
When war erupted in Europe in 1914, most Americans were glad their government chose to keep out of the conflict. For nearly 3 years, Americans embraced neutrality, even though pro-British groups urged the U.S. to come to the rescue of the Allied powers. And pro-German groups, reflecting the nation's largest ethnic minority, together with many Irish Americans, either wanted their country to remain neutral or weigh in militarily on the side of Britain's adversaries. Ultimately, like a giant vortex, the war sucked America out of its geographical and political isolation. In April 1917, the United States declared war on Germany. In the buildup, American artists and illustrators, and some filmmakers too, sold the war to a public that initially remained reluctant to take up arms. At a time when Woodrow Wilson, the President of the United States, mystically invoked the term democracy to justify military intervention abroad, claiming the war had become the only viable means of safeguarding civilization from the barbarism of the enemy, artists and graphic designers searched for ways to depict on two-dimensional surfaces the intangible democratic values that they and other interventionists believed were seriously under threat. Let's begin by focusing on a painting by one of the better known artists of the period, Childe Hassam. Hassam's Early Morning on the Avenue in May 1917 commemorates the dawn, or if you will, the early morning of American involvement in the First World War. The painting depicts Fifth Avenue pedestrians, mostly women, promenading beneath a canopy of flags representing the Allied nations, England, France, Italy, Belgium, and most prominently, the United States of America, which had joined the alliance a month earlier on the declaration of war against Germany. Compositionally, the flags function as a repoussoir, that is, they direct the viewer's eye into the main body of the painting. In this case, the busy thoroughfare thronged with pedestrians and motor cars. But Hassam didn't invent these flags and impose them on the setting for compositional purposes. They actually festooned Fifth Avenue at the time he made the painting in mid-May 1917. They flew from the walls and rooftops of the avenue, as well as many other parts of the city, in a well-orchestrated civic greeting the New Yorkers put on for officials of the alliance who were passing through town on a diplomatic junket to bolster enthusiasm for the Allied cause. Stillness pervades the picture. Aside from the flags, which flutter in the breeze, nothing moves, or only just barely. The back foot of the delivery man crossing the street rises from the pavement, but otherwise, stasis prevails. Pedestrians seem frozen in place, as if by the chalky white ambiance that glazes the image, but also by their attire, which emphasizes length and physical compactness and implicitly inhibits motion. Heads extended upward by fashionable millinery, arms gathered at their sides, calf-length skirts sheathing their legs in a way that would mince their steps, the women occupy space vertically, but do not cross it horizontally. Architecture dominates the setting. The chalky white blocks of St. Thomas's Episcopal Church at left, the cliff-like recession of lofty office towers or hotels at right. The image as a whole is geometric, an orderly array of rectangular slabs constituted by buildings and pedestrians alike. Neatly spaced apart in a grid with only the dancing flags, the patch of opalescent blue sky, and a few diagonal shadows interrupting the up and down regularity of the serenely static world portrayed. The flags bring the city to life, imparting sanguine warmth to its otherwise cool early morning pallor. For contrast, we might look at the work of the urban realist George Bellows. As a leading figure in what later came to be called the Ashcan School, Bellows was Childe Hassam's nemesis. A generation younger, trained in New York rather than Paris, and deeply committed to left-wing politics, Bellows despised the genteel tradition that the older artist exemplified. His paintings of urban life, such as New York, painted in 1911, are dense with crowds, thick with pigment, laden with atmosphere. The paint handling, like the mean streets it depicts, is rough, muscular, and abrasive. Bellows insists on the polyglot, heterogeneous, multi-class, multi-ethnic, multi-layered nature of New York, and by extension, America itself, while Hassam's intent, much the opposite, is to celebrate unity, homogeneity, metropolitan rationality, and order. Is that all making sense? I thought so. Indeed, early morning on the Avenue could even be understood as a riposte to Bellows' 1913 painting, Cliff Dwellers, where it's not ceremonial flags of affiliated nations that flutter and fly over the heads of pedestrians, but linens and underwear hung out to dry. The red, white, and blue color scheme of Hassam's painting is no accident, attesting to the fervor of that moment in history when the United States shrugged off its age-old policy of political isolation and jumped jubilantly onto the world stage. The painting conflates flags, femininity, commercial culture, and religious worship to remind viewers of the democratic verities and values that they were supposedly going to war to defend. A fervent supporter of the alliance, Hassam was elated by his nation's abandonment of neutrality. Like many American artists who had trained in France, in his instance, several decades earlier, he nursed a strong sentimental attachment to the land of his apprenticeship. Early morning on the Avenue is one of more than 30 flag paintings that Hassam produced between 1916 and 1919. As a series, they constitute his last significant body of work. They pay homage to the theme and variation method of the French master he most revered, Claude Monet, who serially painted haystacks, cathedral fronts, and water lilies. More specifically, Hassam's flag paintings allude to works by Monet, such as Terrace at Saint-Adresse from 1867, where two pennants, one nautical, the other national, snap in the seaside breeze. Or even more aptly, Rue Montagoy, Paris, during the celebrations of June 30th, 1878, in which myriad French tricolors sprout from the windows and walls of Parisian buildings like poppies in a field. A handful of Hassam's flag paintings strive for the delirium of Monet's Rue Montagoy. Among these are the 4th of July, 1916, seen here on the left, and Red Cross Drive, May 1918, on the right. But most of Hassam's flag paintings are too circumspect to let loose with such a daring farrago of light, color, and nationalistic fervor. None is more orderly, tranquil, and still than early morning on the Avenue, with its almost Euclidean geometry, in which flat patches of crimson representing the flags rhythmically punctuate the bluish-white recession into space. Hassam was no artistic innovator. There was nothing controversial about his complacent impressionism, in which the armature of solid geometric form holds light's flickering transients securely in check. Long after impressionist technique had been assimilated into American art, the only thing about Hassam's flag paintings that might have struck his contemporaries as controversial was their ardent support of American military intervention. The debate over intervention had begun 2 years earlier, in May 1915, when a German submarine off the coast of Ireland torpedoed a British ocean liner, Lusitania, killing 1,200 men, women, and children, including 128 U.S. citizens. Even though Americans were outraged by this atrocity, many regarded it as an unfortunate instance of what today we call collateral damage. Invoking George Washington's venerable advice to his countrymen not to become entangled in foreign alliances, they rejected military engagement abroad, and in November 1916 re-elected peace candidate Woodrow Wilson, who campaigned on the slogan, "He kept us out of war." Of course, once the USA entered the war, the father of our country changed his tune, as seen in this photo of the popular film star Douglas Fairbanks addressing a Liberty Loan rally on Wall Street. Note how General Washington appears to be approvingly patting him on his head. When Hassan began painting the flag series in 1916, he did so as a full-fledged champion of the preparedness movement. Preparedness advocates urged the government to build up American armed forces and ordnance to unprecedented proportions in order to respond instantly and powerfully when the call to war came, as they were sure it would. They sought every possible means to achieve their goal, and that included sponsoring elaborate Preparedness Day parades in cities across America. This always reminds me of something like you would see in Red Square. One of the leading figures in the preparedness movement was Henry L. Stimson, who had served as Secretary of War under President William Howard Taft. In 1916, Stimson, along with others, including Theodore Roosevelt and J.P. Morgan, Jr., organized the National Defense League, a coalition of prominent bankers, industrialists, corporate heads, and politicians dedicated to heightening America's military prowess. In 1930, a dozen years after the end of the war, Stimson's sister Alice purchased Early Morning on the Avenue with the intention of bequeathing it in his honor to his beloved high school alma mater, the Phillips Academy, Massachusetts. When the painting finally passed into the Academy's collection in 1944, Stimson was again serving as Secretary of War, this time under Franklin Roosevelt and then Roosevelt's successor, Harry Truman. Stimson's top project as War Secretary was the development of nuclear weapons. In the summer of 1945, despite clear indications that Japan was teetering on the verge of surrender, he campaigned tenaciously and at last successfully to overcome the president's reluctance to drop the atomic bomb without warning on the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It's easy to imagine what Stimson would have liked about Early Morning on the Avenue. Portraying his beloved New York City in pristine light, with a Protestant cathedral and Allied flags lofting protectively over its womenfolk, it must have reinforced his desire to defend the homeland at any cost. The prominence of the women in the painting is noteworthy. One of the most effective ways that the war was sold to a public initially reluctant to take up arms was by showing white, middle-class women implicitly or explicitly endangered by the barbarism of the enemy. The melodramatic motif of the violated virgin appeared in numerous recruitment posters both before and after America entered the war. Ellsworth Young's Remember Belgium shows a middle-aged, spike-helmeted Hun, a phallic firearm conspicuously poised between his legs, dragging a reluctant female child by her hand, both of them silhouetted against flames, leaping into a lurid sky. Another poster depicts a dismayed Uncle Sam hovering over the violated body of his daughter, the red stripes of the American flag gushing away from her lap like blood from a burst hymen. "It's up to you," admonishes the text. "Protect the nation's honor. Enlist now." Patriotic posters use the flag as a means of associating threats to American virginity with the defilement of national purity. Particularly noteworthy in this regard were posters designed by the Anglo-Saxon Old Guard triumvirate of Howard Chandler Christie, Harrison Fisher, and the aptly named James Montgomery Flag. The flag frequently serves in their work as a lavish adornment for the fine-figured, delicately featured WASP femininity that they like to purvey as the allegorical symbol for America. These artists belong to the same social set and cultural milieu as both Henry Stimson and Child Hassam. While Hassam's flag paintings feature the white upper-class enclaves of New York and not beautiful young Anglo-Saxon women swathed in flying flags, the linkage between beauty, purity, Puritan lineage, and patriotism is ultimately similar. As one of Child Hassam's admirers wrote shortly after the war, quote, "He made the flags symbolic of his heritage. Only a Puritan could have painted flags as he did." The most famous American recruitment poster of the pre-war period shows a ghostly, wreath-like young mother sinking to the bottom of the sea with an infant cradled in her arms. Bubbles rise from her lips, indicating that she's not yet dead, and a fish floats by as an impassive onlooker. Dark and murky, gray, green, and brown, the oceanic depths surrounding the mother and child chilled viewers who required no supplementary text to understand the picture's allusion to the sinking of the Lusitania. Speer based his poster on a well-known news report that among the 200 bodies that washed ashore was the corpse of a young mother clutching a dead infant at her breast. The poster needs only a single word in capital letters, "enlist," to drive home its point. The Huns had slaughtered innocent American women and children and must never be allowed to do so again. Graphic artist Fred Speer combines 19th century salon painting with the death by drowning dream imagery admired by Pre-Raphaelites and Symbolists to stir righteous indignation for war. His beautiful young mother who sinks to the floor of the ocean because of German brutality is like Flag's sleeping maiden, but so much more tragic and heartrending. Now, I should point out that, this is a quick little aside here. This poster, "Enlist," seems to me almost the perfect paradigm for the transformation that occurred in American advertising at this period. Before World War I, most American ads, if you look in newspapers and magazines, are quite verbose, very text-oriented, and there are no illustrations or just a simple line drawing. I think images like this were meant to catch the eye of people who are on a streetcar, hurtling by at 10 miles an hour, whatever the speed was. Or immigrants to America who couldn't understand a lot of English language, but one word, a strategically placed word next to a powerful image, put the point across very effectively. And many American advertisers, the sort of future of Madison Avenue, I think, was born in the creation of posters like that. And many of the most important publicists and public relations people of the 1920s and 30s had earned their stripes at working for the sort of propaganda offices in America at that time. Another recruitment poster that effectively played on the theme of imperiled womanhood was "Destroy This Mad Brute, Enlist in the U.S. Army." Ludicrously wearing a pickelhaub, a Prussian spiked helmet on his head, and sporting what was known as a Kaiser Wilhelm mustache, a drooling, wild-eyed gorilla clutches a cudgel marked Kultur in one hand and a swooning, half-naked female in the other. With a ruined cathedral visible on the horizon behind him, the snarling ape has sprung across the ocean to plant his hairy feet on the shores of America. A caption explains, "If this war is not fought to a finish in Europe, it will be on the soil of the United States." The shocking Beauty and the Beast imagery of Destroy This Mad Brute, which appeared in 1917, anticipates by more than a decade and a half the Hollywood fantasy classic King Kong. It also refers back to French academic sculpture of the late 19th century. So powerful and disturbing was the imagery of Destroy This. I mean, see, we might look at it today and go, oh, that's funny, or how quaint, it's so cartoonish. But this was something that really upset people to see at the time. So powerful and disturbing was the imagery of Destroy This Mad Brute. The Nazi propaganda minister, Joseph Goebbels, reproduced it in a poster of his own on the eve of the Second World War. The text of Goebbels' poster reads, "When they assaulted us 25 years ago, they wrote on their rotten, slanderous poster, 'Destroy this mad brute.' They meant the German people." A few years later, an Italian fascist artist appropriated the motif for an anti-American poster that warned against the likely misdeeds of the American invaders of the Italian peninsula. Showing a thuggish African-American sergeant looting a Venus de Milo with a ridiculously low price of $2 stamped on her flesh, the image reverses the terms of Destroy This Mad Brute to invoke the threat of racial, sexual, cultural, and even economic depredation of the Italian homeland by monstrous and not very bright Americans. Now, just to track this image a little bit further into the future, namely 2008, Annie Leibovitz took this notorious image of LeBron James and Gisele Bündchen for the cover of Vogue magazine, and this was rightly understood as a very racist image, and was, when I tried to reproduce it in the book I was writing on the subject, Vogue wouldn't even give me permission to show this image. Now, many people looked at it and thought, well, it's a spoof on King Kong, but really Annie Leibovitz was looking even further back to Destroy This Mad Brute, making it. And the poster, again, I won't take the time to go into this now, but you can see that Destroy This Mad Brute, as I argue in my book, I think it was very much drawn from D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, which had appeared 2 years earlier in 1915. And so it's about, yes, the evil Huns, the evil Germans, what they can do to white womanhood. But there's a subtext, and not, what they call like a whistle signal, a dog whistle here, to African-American fears by whites of African-Americans, but also of immigrants. This is very much an anti-immigration image, showing a brutish, loutish figure leaping across the shores from in this case, Europe, as indicated by the Gothic ruins on the side, onto the shores of America. So there are multiple signifiers at work in an image like this, and I think that's part of its perpetual power. One of the only consistent sources of anti-war visual imagery was the radical social magazine, The Masses. George Bellows, a frequent contributor, aroused censors with his 1917 drawing of Jesus in jail. Manacled, clad in convict's pajamas, bound by ball and chain, the Prince of Peace has been imprisoned for preaching the seditious words, "Thou shalt not kill," during wartime. Robert Miners, at last, a perfect soldier, published the previous year, satirically shows a medical examiner rubbing his hands in glee as he admires a gigantic, headless, bare-chested recruit, literally all brawn and no brains. Henry Glintenkamp's 1917 drawing of a skeleton measuring a naked young recruit for his coffin stirred such outrage that the artist was indicted under the Wartime Espionage Act and had to flee to Mexico to avoid trial. The magazine, The Masses, subsequently went out of business when faced with a series of prosecutions for its anti-war activism, which the government deemed treasonous. They're not an anti-war image. So just to make the point clear, once America declared war on Germany, within a month, it became against the law to produce any kind of written text or visual images that could be seen as opposing the American War Act. And then these laws were tightened a year later in another anti-sedition act. Though not an anti-war image per se, Paul Strand's famous photograph, Wall Street, exhibited, do you know this image? Some of you do, okay. Strand's photograph, Wall Street, exhibited by Alfred Stieglitz in 1916, portrays Gotham in a manner that seems strikingly unpatriotic compared to Hassam's loving views of the city. White-collar workers tread in heavily shadowed isolation into the maw of the coldly impersonal corporate machine, as represented by the vast coffin-like window casements over their heads. Such are the loaded terms in which Strand's left-wing cohorts would have understood the image, which perfectly embodies the viewpoint of the era's cultural radicals toward capitalist America. What a contrast to early morning on the avenue. In both images, pedestrians pass beneath an immense edifice in the early light, in the bright light of early morning. But in the painting, it's a Fifth Avenue Anglican church, and in the photo, a Wall Street bank. The painting exudes old-fashioned gentility, the photograph, modernist alienation. Hassam's Fifth Avenue shoppers are symbolically safeguarded by the flags of the Allied nations waving over their heads. Strand's Wall Street workers lack any such protection. Passive, unresisting, they march to work like Eloy, docilely proceeding to slaughter by the Morlocks in H.G. Wells' late Victorian science fiction allegory, The Time Machine, or, in a more fitting analogy, like foot soldiers heading to the front. The Wall Street building beneath which they trudge is not any old building, but the headquarters of financial giant J.P. Morgan. Okay, just another ad-lib here. This building, Morgan Bank building, became the symbol for capitalist America as the World Trade Center was to become more than half a century later. It was, if there was any one single image that would register for people as the symbol of American capitalism, it was this building. And interestingly, shortly after World War I, somebody, presumably anarchist terrorists, tried to bomb the building, and a number of people were killed in the bomb blast on Wall Street. And there never was proven who did it, but certainly the right claimed that it was the anarchists, the left wing, that did it. But the House of Morgan, the bank, was instrumental in bringing the United States into the war. It floated huge loans worth billions of dollars to the British and French governments. Over the 2.5-year course of America's neutrality, the bank served as the purchasing agent for the British in North America, buying food and supplies to be shipped to England. In violation of neutrality laws, it also procured munitions. Ironically, though this was not made public until after the armistice, Lusitania was carrying a contraband cargo of Morgan munitions. Scholars have speculated that the torpedo breached the hold where these were stockpiled, and in doing so, touched off a chain reaction that caused the ship to sink with unprecedented speed before lifeboats could be lowered. By these lights, the Morgan Bank inadvertently, but nonetheless directly, played a role in carnage that could otherwise have been avoided. Surely few, if any, viewers would have compared early morning on the avenue to Strand's Wall Street, if only because the audiences for the two images were so different from one another. But those who admired Hassam's patriotic Manhattan street scenes might possibly have regarded them in light of the unsettling news photographs that were then filtering back from war-torn Europe, such as this 1917 photo of Ypres. The center of the Belgian town, the site of four major battles, is pillared with rubble. Its once glorious medieval Gothic buildings form bare ruined choirs, and the British foot soldiers filing in formation down the city's otherwise deserted main avenue form a martial counterpart to Haslam's female pedestrians strolling placidly past a Gothic Revival church on Fifth Avenue. Here are these two images triangulated with strands. Forming an even greater contrast to the Haslam painting, although with the same ultimate intent of stirring emotions in favor of the war, is Joseph Pennell's 1918 poster promoting liberty bonds. In this apocalyptic fantasy, the Statue of Liberty has been decapitated. Her famous head lies submerged in New York Harbor, while enemy warplanes bomb Manhattan into a seething cauldron of smoke and flame. The nightmare envisioned, an eerie premonition of airborne attacks 83 years later, provides a dark, dystopian counterpart to Haslam's light-drenched, flag-fluttering pins to America's great metropolis. The visual rhetoric of the image itself was no less inflammatory than the incendiary bombs raining down from the sky. 2 million prints of the poster circulated throughout the land and seized Americans with anger and dread at the thought of an airstrike on the Manhattan skyline, exacerbating their determination to take the war to the enemy over there before the enemy brought it over here. Recruitment posters such as this 1917 image by graphic designer Laura Bray applied psychological techniques similar to those later used to sell men cars, cigarettes, and neckties by appealing to their status anxieties. A well-groomed, well-dressed young man stands beside a large window in the abstract darkness of an unspecified interior, while a parade of doughboys marches by outside in the brilliant sunlight. Lost in contemplation, he resembles the saturnine figure in Thomas Aikens's turn-of-the-century icon of introspection, The Thinker, which achieved prominence that same year at the Metropolitan Museum's memorial exhibition for the recently deceased artist. The radiance of the flag and Bray's poster backlights the young man's pensive, shadow-sculpted face. Above him, bright yellow letters outlined in black urge him to enlist. At his feet, in the darkness, a nagging question besets him, and by implication, every other young man who had not yet enlisted. On which side of the window are you? The gender politics of images such as this are plain, and this was one of the more subtle instances. Most recruitment posters leapt instantly for the jugular. In them, men who signed up to fight were real men, like the hunky soldiers loading their large, rigid weapon. In these men have come across. They are at the front now. With similar macho bravado, a sailor straddles an enormous phallic torpedo. In an uncanny anticipation of the infamous ending to Stanley Kubrick's 1964 black comedy about nuclear holocaust, Dr. Strangelove, the serviceman gleefully rides his personal bomb, rodeo style, toward its final obliterating destination. Howard Chandler Christie's flirtatious brunette in a sailor suit succinctly expresses the overriding sentiment of these recruitment posters. Gee, I wish I were a man. I'd join the Navy. The best known, most often reproduced, and most often parodied poster to come out of the First World War is James Montgomery Flagg's I Want You for U.S. Army, picturing a scowling Uncle Sam in patriotic garb, jabbing an admonitory finger at the potential recruit. Flagg's source for the poster was a 1914 British recruitment poster by Alfred Leet, showing Field Marshal and War Secretary Lord Horatio Herbert Kitchener staring down potential British recruits. Leet's poster is dead serious in intent, whereas Flagg's, in keeping with American folk humor traditions, is somewhat sly in its flavor, as if to address the viewer with a certain amount of tongue-in-cheek levity, a nod and a wink that flatters the viewer for being in on the game. Flagg often liked to allude to flags in his paintings. He put himself as he posed himself as Uncle Sam. He was a dapper and handsome individual, much taken with his own good looks. And thus, with his name, he liked to further appeal to his narcissistic impulses. Child Hassam's flag feelings reflected and reinforced the so-called flagophilia, as it was some people called it, of the United States in the run-up to and then during the First World War. The American holiday known as Flag Day was introduced in 1916, but the Stars and Stripes had been a symbol of patriotic ardor for at least half a century before that, ever since rebel troops took down the federal flag at Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor as the inaugurating blow of the Civil War. On several occasions in the late 19th century, flag protection bills were introduced in Congress. The target of this legislation was not protesters, but retailers who had discovered that flying the flag in advertisements and window displays was a surefire way to peddle merchandise. The proposed bill, so people didn't want the flag desecrated by all these advertisers. The proposed bill failed only because congressmen feared that it would prohibit them from using the flag themselves in their re-election campaigns. Flag protection acts were put forward again at the start of the 20th century. This time, the target was not commercial advertising, but political protest. Indeed, anarchists, socialists, and labor activists sometimes literally rent or burnt the flag as a way of making a point. Showing respect or disrespect for the flag became a way of expressing one's viewpoint, not necessarily about America in the abstract, but about the country as presently governed. Occasionally, the Stars and Stripes served as a symbolic prop in the staging of public violence by vigilantes who sought to punish and humiliate foreign-born radical or working-class individuals who they deemed insufficiently patriotic. The most egregious instance of this occurred in April 1918 when a mob in southern Illinois wrapped a German-born Union activist, Robert Prager, in a large American flag and forced him to march up and down the street waving and kissing smaller flags before they hanged him from a tree. When the leaders of the lynch party were subsequently tried and acquitted by a jury of their peers, a local band celebrated by striking up the Star Spangled Banner over there and other flag-waving tunes. Once Americans finished stateside training and began to fight and die in Flanders and France, the mood in America turned a lot less jocular. Antipathy toward all things German spread like a virus. German Americans, particularly labor activists, were targeted by vigilante groups for harassment, even to the point of lynching. Anti-German sentiment didn't always take such a violent turn, however. More typical was the renaming of sauerkraut Liberty Cabbage, Frankfurters Liberty Dogs, and hamburgers Liberty Steaks. Beethoven and Brahms were banished from concert programs. Still, the mood was ugly and grew uglier as the war progressed and casualties mounted. One artist who changed his tune at this time was George Bellows, whose anti-war cartoon we looked at earlier. Bellows had made his name with saucy or sardonic satires of the urban bourgeoisie and their underclass counterparts. His acerbic paintings and drawings of drunks, preachers, wife beaters, weight reducers, homeless, poor, fight fans, and public executioners established his reputation as America's Daumier. He viewed the world from a distinctly left-wing perspective, but frequently with a comic view, sometimes subtle and droll, and other times brash and Rabelaisian. As late as the summer of 1917, he satirized the nation's hunger for war, as with the previously mentioned cartoon of Jesus in jail for preaching pacifism. Bellows was looking closely in those days at Francisco Goya's early 19th century series of etchings known collectively as The Disasters of War, which had recently been exhibited in New York. Note how Christ in chains in his drawing echoes the stooped posture of the Spanish insurgent tied to an execution post in plate 15 of The Disasters. But then something changed for Bellows, the pacifist. He became convinced the reports of German atrocities against civilians were not merely Allied propaganda, but in fact true. Early in 1918, he embarked on a campaign of art against the Germans that is extraordinary in its rage and ferocity. No American artistic depiction of war before or since has been so fully realized in the completeness of its attack. With Goya's disasters of war very much in mind, he feverishly turned out a series of lithographs that describe in ghastly detail the German army's murderous march through neutral Belgium, raping, pillaging, and torturing large numbers of civilians whose insurgency they brutally sought to contain. Now, because I will be giving a public lecture on Bellows and his dramatic turnabout in Trinity Term on the 17th of May, to be exact, I won't chronicle his war art here. Instead, I'd like to end by looking at one last artist from the period, the great Anglo-American portrait and landscape painter John Singer Sargent. At the start, the war held little interest for Sargent, then in his late 50s, and he didn't even bother to read about it in the newspapers or cut short a painting expedition in Austria. His relationship with his longtime friend and fellow expatriate, Henry James, seen here in Sargent's pre-war portrait, cooled in those early days of the war, because James, consumed with concern for the Allied cause, could not countenance Sargent's apparent aloofness. In 1918, however, the painter's mood began to shift. In March of that year, his beloved niece, Rosemarie Ormond André Michel, who he said had the most beautiful hands he had ever drawn and who had accompanied him on several sketching tours, was killed by a German bomb that struck the Parisian church in which she was praying. Grieving, he accepted an invitation by the British High Command to serve his adopted land as an official war artist. He and a fellow painter, Henry Tonks, came over to France that summer and, safely stationed behind the front lines, spent hours every day looking for scenes of interest to paint or draw. Sargent depicted soldiers sleeping, bathing, foraging for fruit, and so forth. But none of these vignettes captured the pain or poignancy of war. One day, on an outing near Arras, Sargent and Tonks came upon a dressing station where they saw groups of soldiers filing behind one another, their eyes wrapped in bandages. These men were victims of blinding mustard gas. Sargent asked Tonks if he would mind terribly if he took the subject for himself. Tonks agreed. Sargent began sketching what he saw, which was individuals who could no longer see. What could be more disturbing for an artist than sudden and possibly irreversible blindness? Later, after the armistice, Sargent converted the scores of drawings and studies that he had begun making that day into a giant mural of blindness. An enormous rectangular painting, 9 feet high and 20 feet long, gassed as big as the movie theater screens of half a century later, and similarly shaped to accommodate motion along the horizontal. Yet its formal lineage derives from the monumental temple friezes of the ancient Greeks, and the work smacks of Greek tragedy, where men suffer blindness, madness, and agonizing death at the whim of indifferent gods. Set against a blank sky tinged with lavender, cream, and mustard tones, suggestive of the invisible gas that poisoned them, 9 sightless infantrymen stumble in single file down a dirt road. Several of them wield a rifle, a firearm with a built-in sight, that is, a mechanism for guiding the eye. That they do so only heightens the painting's aura of futility. Each man steadies himself by resting his arm on the shoulder of the blind man in front of him. A medical orderly, also in uniform, helps them on their way. One of the wounded approaches a board lying in the road. I don't know if I have a laser pointer. Yeah. He lifts his leg in an exaggerated way, as if the orderly has cautioned him to mind his step. In a brief review of the painting, Virginia Woolf called attention to the poignant irony of this little vignette. A dozen or so sufferers with white cloth wrapped around their eyes sprawl or sit in the foreground, some clutching their heads, and many more lie similarly dazed or dying on the other side of the road. Far to the right, Orderlies herd another column of blind men toward a hospital tent, which Sergeant does not show, but suggests by an array of taut guy lines that diagonally cross the painting's right-hand corner. The pale white disc of the setting sun lodged in the gap between the two columns of walking blind burns low on the horizon of this seemingly endless purgatory. Vera Britton, a nurse's aide who was stationed that year at a similar dressing station, wrote home, quote, "I wish those people who write so glibly about this being a holy war and the orders who talk so much about going on no matter how long the war lasts and what it may mean, I wish they could see a case, to say nothing of 10 cases, of mustard gas in its early stages." She goes on to describe the symptoms of those who were gassed, quote, "The poor things all burnt and blistered all over with great suppurating blisters, with blind eyes all sticky and stuck together, and always fighting for breath, their voices a mere whisper, saying their throats are closing and they know they will choke." Sargent's painting alludes to Peter Bruegel's late 1560s masterpiece, The Parable of the Blind Leading the Blind, which in turn refers to Christ's utterance in the Sermon on the Mount, "If the blind lead the blind, both shall fall into a ditch." Thus invoking the biblical proverb, Gast implicitly criticizes the war. Excuse me. That is, the handling of the war by blind politicians and generals, men who absurdly wield far more dangerous weapons than mere rifles. In the years immediately following the war, criticisms of blind leadership became widespread throughout the former combatant nations, especially in Europe. The British called their generals donkeys for the obstinate, thick-headed way they sent wave after wave of men to the slaughter without seriously considering alternative strategies. When shortly after the armistice, the trustees of London's National Portrait Gallery invited Sargent to paint a large group portrait of 22 wartime generals, he declined the commission, quote, "with the greatest regret," for he had already announced his retirement from portraiture. "No more portraits," he had sneered in private. But excuses would not do, and he succumbed to pressure to produce what eventually, after more than 2 years of effort to master the impossible, turned out to be the most lifeless and monotonous group portrait he ever painted. Stiff, cold, impersonal, the donkeys stand closely packed together in a nondescript, undefined setting at the base of a pair of huge classical columns. In that space, they are little men. With similar size, format, and reference to Greek or Roman antiquity, the painting forms a pendant to Gast, but has none of its pathos or captivating detail. 22 scowling, smiling, or would-be debonair heads, nearly as many mustaches, 42 eyes, all but two of the assembled generals look straight ahead, dozens of boots, belts, buckles, and leather cross straps, and a plethora of medals, pins, insignia, ceremonial swords, and silver-tipped batons overwhelm the viewer with ennui, as surely they did the painter. A future director of the National Portrait Gallery dismissively characterized this group portrait as still life with boots. Was Sargent mocking the generals in his own very dignified and reticent way? Perhaps not intentionally so, and yet his distinct lack of enthusiasm for his project may at some level have been generated by his abiding lack of enthusiasm for the war and those who directed it. While some general officers of the Great War, as this elephantine painting is known, does not indulge in the sort of overt general bashing performed by the post-war German caricaturists Otto Dix and George Grosz, it nonetheless presents a collective portrait of narcissism, conformity, and the ultimate failing in the world of Sargent's portraiture, rigidity, on the part of the high command. Perhaps the more apt painterly comparison would be to Goya's depictions of desiccated or jowling ministers and generals swaddled in immensities of ribbon and brocade, or perhaps most of all to his notorious depictions of the Spanish royal family as a collection of aristocratic buffoons, too stupid and vain to recognize themselves as such. As a pendant to Gast, but also its antithesis, some general officers of the Great War allows us to understand more fully the anti-war sentiment that fueled Sargent's earlier depiction of lowly foot soldiers suffering blindness, isolation, and loss. Let me make explicit a point that has woven through my lecture this afternoon. American art during the First World War was never monolithic, with artists and propagandists and commercial illustrators all riding the same ideological express train in support of the nation's war effort. Far from it. During this period of political turbulence, artists moved in dramatically different directions from one another, and even, in some instances, as with Bellows, lurched in different directions from themselves. World War I was the first time in American history in which artists and other makers of compelling visual imagery exerted a formidable influence on the way their fellow Americans thought about and engaged in war. It would not be the last. Thank you.